I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we're talking with Associate Professor Leanne Motley, who is with the Department of Geography, Environmental Management, and Energy Studies at the University of Johannesburg. She holds a PhD in Environmental Management and plays a leading role in the development and delivery of ESG and sustainability-related courses, both at the University of Johannesburg and the Johannesburg Business School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dr. Amalia. I am so honored and grateful to be here.
We appreciate it. And I'm going to start off from your educational sphere, because we are passionate believers about the power of education as an enabler for women. You hold a BSc in natural sciences. You've got an honors in zoology, master's in environmental management, and PhD in environmental management, as well as a plethora of other courses. You've consciously developed yourself and invested into the field of environmental management and sustainability. Please, can you walk us through some of the defining moments that have shaped your journey in this field?
Okay, so to start off, I actually wanted to be a medical doctor, but was never accepted into the mainstream. So it was a very quick journey into UJ where they said, okay, you can do zoology and human physiology, which I knew nothing about, but decided to take this exciting journey. I ended up completing my BSc and then studied honors in zoology just because it was a convenient option. So it was at that point, it was no passion at all, except I'm at UJ and this is what they're offering, this funding available. I went into zoology and then I started working briefly. I then decided that I would come back to UJ and do my master's, which was in environmental management. Again, just trying to pivot into what I didn't understand, but what people said would be a nice degree to do. And I think it's also important to mention that from my first graduation, my father, he was proud, but he said, there's a philosophized doctor. What is that? You need to get it. So every other graduation, he would say, okay, well done, but when do you get the doctorate? So for me, stopping was not an option. And sometimes I say to my students, you know, my driver for a PhD was completely different. Whether I wanted to do it or not, I didn't have a choice because my father insisted, you have to do this. You have to get this doctorate. Whatever it is, you need to get it. So it's different now because I think students do doctorates for different reasons. But for me, it was just solely my father driving me towards this degree. And I think since the honors, I was so deeply entrenched into water quality, water monitoring. And when I started doing my own work, I started realizing that, you know, it was one day in the Karlsbad River in Tembisa when we were monitoring the water, and I saw someone come out of the house and just take their bin and throw it into the water. And I thought to myself, you know, we can continue monitoring the water, but what about the people? When do we speak to them? When do we ask them, why are you doing this? What do you think of the water? And I think that was one of the pivotal shifts in my career, because that's when I started realizing that as a scientist, we can do the science, but it is a futile effort if you are not involving people. This was my most difficult journey. I'm a scientist, a thoroughbred scientist. And then I started working with people, which was the most difficult part of my life because, you know, working with fish all my life, you get your fish, you kill them, they don't ask questions, no one's saying, I can't today, you know, and then I get into people where it's, why are you asking us? What do we get? Not today, tomorrow. And, you know, it took so much from me to get into this social space, but reminding myself consistently that I cannot do the science without the people. And I think that was one of the pivotal shifts in my career where I realized that I can just monitor the water every day, all day, but the quality will not change unless I engage with the people who are causing the quality to change. And I think that's where the shift started coming. And even though I'm still a scientist, I don't call myself a social scientist, but I'm really in between the two. Understanding the impact of the environment on people, but also the impact of people on the environment.
Wow. Well, thanks for walking us through aspects of your journey. I want to tap back into one of the important factors that you mentioned about your dad being your pivotal driver, motivator, and just how powerful it is to have someone in your corner believing
Yeah.
in you. Share some insights into that.
So I think my father, he really invested in education. And even I remember while I was working and I got the offer at UJ, there was no salary attached. And I said to my father, I need to go back. I've now have this opportunity to do the PhD that you've insisted on. Will you just assist me financially for the next 2 years? I'm going to finish my PhD quickly so that I can work and I can stand on my own 2 feet. And he agreed without blinking. And my father had a small shop. He wasn't working, but he said, you know what, if to get your education, I will do what I can. And I came back, signed the contract, and I said, oh, I'm actually getting a salary, which was unexpected. But he said, no, but it's fine. Even if you can put your salary aside, just do finish the PhD so you have this education. And I think he always motivated me, and with few words. When I say, oh, this is so difficult, you know you can do it. You know you can do it. And it's nothing, just do it. So eventually I got my PhD, was really proud. And I remember he sat me down one day and he said, it's not over now. You now need to come back to the community and now you need to help the other girls. So all the girls need to see that you have done it and you need to help them get to where you are. And, I remember obviously working at the university. My father would, in January every year, he would phone me, would say, there's this girl. She did well in matric. Please help her get in. And I said, but I don't have the power to do that. And he'd phone me the whole day. He said, please, Annie, you have to try. And I had to, speak to people and say, please, please, please help me. My father is. So eventually, and I remember in 2014, there was one girl that he said to me, please just help this girl, guide her. And, we did it. She eventually got in. And that year, 2024, September, my dad actually passed away, unfortunately. And this year, 2026, the girl sent me a message and she said, you know what, Leanne, I'm finishing my degree this year. And I cannot thank your father in person for what he did, because even though you played a role, your dad came to my house to insist you will go study and we'll make a plan. So one of the other girls also graduated the other day and she said, please come because your father can't be here. So it wasn't about me. The journey that he wanted me to take was more to come back into our community, filled with societal ills, filled with drugs and anything negative you can think about, and come and lift another girl up to also get to that point. So I think as much as my father pushed me, he was pushing me so I could come back and grab another girl's hand and also push her further. So yeah, I think that was for me the best thing he could have done for me is not educate me, but help me get other people educated. So it doesn't just stop with me. But every girl in our community can see that, you know what, it's possible. And when I get it, I go back to the community.
What a fantastic legacy. And obviously, very sorry that he's passed on, but he has made an impact in this world.
I agree. I think it's such a phenomenal impact, because sitting back, I always thought, this person is insisting that I do a PhD. He wanted, the doctorate. And I think this year when I got promoted to associate professor, I said, I wish he could have seen this part of the story. And everyone said, "Oh, but your father told everyone already you are professor."
Wonderful. When
So,
we
yeah.
were starting the conversation, you spoke about your experience of the water monitoring project in Tembisa and the reality of seeing people just toss their rubbish into this water that you're monitoring, and the fact that if you don't help and educate the community, that monitoring is really not going to be solving anything. So can you tell us about a few research projects that you've been particularly proud about and the impact that they've had on communities?
So I've worked in Tembisa, and what we've done in Tembisa basically is trying to find out from the community what your main issues are, and if any project is initiated in the community, would you be on board? So I think it's a long journey to getting communities on board, because building trust is probably the most difficult thing that I've had to do in this journey. So it's a slow process, because you need to speak to them. Listen, here's the problems. Are you interested? Do you care? Can we rely on you to help us with this? And most times, contrary to popular belief, people actually want to get involved. So the township communities that I've worked in, Tembisa, Soweto, El Dorado Park, most of the time people are saying, "Yes, we know there's a problem. How do we fix it?" So it's getting their buy-in, going back, testing the water, and saying, "Okay, this is the pollutants that we found. This could be the cause." So we're not blaming anyone. We're just saying this could be the cause. And then going back and saying, "So how do you think you can help us? Firstly, this is what we're planning on doing. What do you think we can do?" And I think working in townships, it's a whole different world, because most of the time the assumption is that government should be helping us with our water. And government is saying, "We won't help until you come to the party." So it's, especially in El Dorado Park, it's a tug, because both sides are saying, "Yes, we're interested. Yes, we want to help, but what is the other one bringing?" So sometimes working in townships can be extremely difficult, because people also haven't taken ownership of their rivers or their water resources. But of course, and the projects are slower, because government, of course, wants to see what the community will bring before they come on board. And it's not financial resources, it's buy-in. Is the community on board if we start a filtration system? Is the community on board? And this type of information is crucial. So I've done many of these studies in these areas where we have credible evidence or proof or research that the community is on board. Government now needs to come to the party. But if I look at the work that I've done in rural areas, for example, in Limpopo, the perception and the attitude is completely different, because here people, they are custodians of the water. They believe the water is theirs. So you can drink the water in these areas, because they firmly believe that this is our resource and we need to look after it. So it shortens the process a bit, because once we get in, they already have their concerns, and now the next conversation is co-creation. How do we find solutions to make sure the water quality remains the same, the water quantity doesn't get diminished with climate change? How do we build resilience? And we do that together. So working in these different areas has given me different perspectives on how to deal with certain people. But as I say, in Limpopo, it took me 4 years to win their trust. So, if you're in academia, no one wants to hear an article is taking 4 years. So it's been a slow journey, but nonetheless a journey that needs to be taken, because you need to build a trust.
And for instance, thinking about the community in Limpopo with this psyche of preservation of the water, that the water is ours, we want to protect, conserve this resource. How do you try and translate that psyche over to people who are living in urban populations or urban environments where they don't tend to have that same appreciation for water as a resource?
So I think the first thing is getting them to understand that they are the custodians of the water. The water belongs to you. This is your water. And I think once you have that mindset change of ownership, everything changes. So you treat it differently. And it sounds like an easy process, but it's not. Because for many years, even in El Dorado Park, people would say, yes, but it's the government that needs to look after this river. It belongs to them. And we need to explain, but it's in your backyard. So if you don't look after it, first of all, there's a wetland. When it floods, your home floods. So we then took a step back and firstly started explaining the impacts of poor water quality on them. So once they realize that, okay, there is something, a disadvantage if I don't look after this water. That was the first step. The second step was like, now that you know that any negative impact can detrimentally impact you, now you understand that you need to look after it. Once you start looking after it, you start taking ownership. Because now, when we go to the community, there isn't as much dumping as there used to be. Because people would now say, no, we clean this stream on weekends, and now you're dumping. So it's a small shift. But as you know, changing a mindset is, it's a task that sometimes seems impossible. But I do believe with small steps, we can actually make the difference that we are trying to, just to change the mindset. And yes, it comes from creating awareness. Yes, it comes from knowledge sharing, but also building with them on what do you think will work in your community.
And you've highlighted that crucial point that climate change isn't someone else's problem. It's my problem. It's your
Yes.
problem. It's the community's problem. And that the impact is actually deeply human. Staying with water for a moment, you've been very involved in water security, dam sustainability projects, and also highlighting critical environmental risks. As consumers, or let's say hopefully custodians one day of water, what are some of the most urgent issues you think we should be paying attention to?
So I think, when you work with water and everyone has been hearing on the news that many of these issues are structural. So it's infrastructure issues that needs to be sorted. But I think that conversation sort of removes people from it. So it removes the common person. It removes people who are not working in academia or working for the wastewater treatment plant. So they tend to think, this is not our conversation. But that is a crucial flaw, I think, because we need to get to a point where we fully embody integrated water resource management, where everyone plays a role. So it's discussing with the stakeholders, it's speaking to everyone and highlighting the importance of even the communities. Because if you think about it, yes, it's a structural issue, but if we keep throwing nappies into the stream, if we keep it just exacerbates those issues that are currently there. So you would look at it as a high level issue saying, you know what, let's sort out the structural issues. It's going to cause billions. But if you go down to grassroots level and start educating at that level, and then you'll start seeing changes because now people are starting to understand, oh, hold up. If I'm disposing of my solid waste into the stream, it means further down there might be a blockage, which means if the flood hits this area, my home will flood first. So I can start with a small action, for example, not disposing of solid waste into the river. That then involves everyone into the conversation. And when people start seeing it that way, so even going into communities, we don't come, usually as scientists, we think we know everything. But we come in and we say to them, what would you do? And many times people would say, I would start with those concrete bins so people can throw their rubbish into the bin and not into the stream. It's a small action, but it takes those stakeholders engaging with us and telling us what would work in their community. So really it's about co-creation. And I think this is also what sometimes takes very long is building trust and then getting people to understand how pivotal and vital their role is in this. Because many times we feel like, oh, it's the government's issue. No. if you can take your chocolate wrapper and throw it in the bin at home as opposed to on the street, we one step closer to solid waste pollution in the river being cleared up.
You're very passionate about the work that you do as a scientist within communities, but over and above the, let's say, the core day job, you have a number of different community initiatives, such as Eco Scout and the I Am Girls program, which goes towards uplifting others and, as we mentioned earlier, fulfilling aspects of your dad's legacy. What would you say drives your commitment to community engagement?
So I think for the longest time, I think my community has been neglected. And I always felt not just convicted because of my father's push, but also that if I am coming from this community, they need to benefit from what I know. So I invest quite a bit of my time into the young girls because I want to change the narrative. I want them to understand that there are other things and better things for you to do than sit at home waiting for, someone to bring money so you could eat, having babies, being on drugs, substance abuse. So I want to change that story for them. And of course, I cannot do it for 100 girls, but we can start with 20 girls. And over the years, these numbers, whether they increase or not, at least we get one cohort out and it's 20 girls that's minds have been changed. So for me, changing the mind is the most important thing. So this has really pushed me in terms of how does my community benefit from me being in academia, from me completing my PhD, because at the end of the day, we need to see beyond ourselves and think about where we come from and how we can make a change there. And then the Eco Scouts is more younger, so really young children. And that is a partnership with an environmental group in El Dorado Park where we teach them at a younger age. So we know that if your child comes back from school and you've left the tap open, they'll always be like, "Oh, mommy, close the tap." It that conviction because now you feel guilty. So we trying to change the minds of the young ones so that when they go home, they automatically, because you feel guilty. There's not a single person that would not feel guilty if a younger person is telling you, "No, close the tap. You're wasting water." So then environmentalists is a very interesting program where we try and teach them environmental stewardship at grassroots level, which I sometimes feel is lacking in the schools. And there's a number of initiatives. We're doing animations. We're trying to get it to a level where if we can't change your mind, we'll leave it to your children to change your mind.
Having this conversation sheds light on so many deeper layers. One, when we spoke earlier about people's view of, it's the government's problem, it's the government's problem, and being able to take accountability for their actions on the environment. And when you were talking about the I Am Girls program, that in this particular program of thinking about taking accountability for yourself. So having that mindset shift, all of these are kind of like transferable skills in a way, that accountability for yourself. No one's coming to rescue you. Go and do this on your own. What message would you like to share with young girls who may be listening and dreaming of careers in science, sustainability, or leadership?
So I think it's rare from our community seeing people go into science. I think we consistently being pushed into the mainstream medicine, accounting, law, and science is one of those very difficult subjects that if we could advise you, rather not. So I try every year to bring them to the university and show them that science is a wide world of possibilities and it's not just looking through a microscope. So, I try as hard as I can to change their mind towards science because I think it starts in school where the teacher's like, science is difficult and not everyone can do science. So I try to push the narrative that it's not just a microscope. There is a lot when it comes to science, and anyone can do it because I didn't think I'd end up in science. So, it's again changing the mindset, changing the perspective, and showing them the fun side of science. So it's, of course, it's difficult if their teachers see them every day, and I see them some Saturdays, along with the IM group, which is also faith-based. But just being able to show them every now and then that look at how much fun we're having with the science, and making science fashionable and fun and exciting, so they look and they're like, oh, so we can also do science, which, once that light bulb goes on, I think my job is done here.
And you've been very pioneering in the work that you do and in how you have shifted your own mindset and become a role model for women who are coming up behind you and girls. One thing that I want to ask you, because we're a gender-based program, is that sometimes women do experience gender challenges in their fields. Have you experienced any gender-related barriers in your journey, and if so, how did you navigate them?
So I think coming from a zoology background, this is a very interesting question, because in zoology, there's no gender. So we are all doing the same work. We are all killing fish. We are all catching our own fish. We are all putting the boat in, and there is no gender here. So I think, and we laugh about it now, but for going through it, I was like, but can't they see I'm a girl? And I think looking back now, I actually appreciate that story. I appreciate them not seeing that I'm a girl, because now, when I get students saying, oh, but I can't, because I was in the field 5 months pregnant. I was going under the fence. And my supervisor was like, well, this is the project, and this is how we get the water. And very gently, but from that moment, I knew that whatever they can do, I can do it. With a baby in my tummy, I can still do it. So I think more than make me feel, more than having a negative impact on me, it actually strengthened me. And when I got into environmental management and more sustainability, I realized that the narrative is changing. There's more women. Women are really at the forefront of this conversation and leading sustainability conversations. And it's not because, we like it more. It's just because sustainability and females just go together. I'm not saying it's not for men, but I'm saying that there's certain aspects of sustainability that really speaks to who we are as females. So we are able to see things from a holistic point of view. Looking at ecosystems, it's not just the ecosystem, it's the finance, it's the people. So that holistic point of view, but also the empathy that comes with it. So, that caring nature, community stewardship, all of these things is inherent to who we are as women. So it makes it almost, it's effortless. We do it, and we do it this way because that's how we are. That's how we mother. That's how we with our own children. So it's easy to do it with other children. It's easy to do it with other communities. So I think us leading the conversation is more because of the soft skills that is in our DNA. And, probably if you asked me 10 years ago as a hard scientist, I probably would have had a different answer to this. But right now, I think just looking at the field, it's more about who we are. So, to any woman trying to get into this field, I would say stay true to yourself, because that's what we need. We don't need you to be like the men in the field. We don't need you to be, masculine. We need you to bring your soft side, because that's essentially the engine for the sustainability movement.
Yeah, that people piece that you've been talking about is so
Yes.
crucial, because if you don't get the buy-in of the people, nothing is going to be
Yes,
sustainable.
exactly. So, I think in many of my projects, I've seen it, that, people sometimes feel neglected, they feel undermined. And when we go into communities, it's a little bit of a conversation first on how important you are, how important your inputs are. We cannot do this project without your perspective. And many times, and I think specifically in these communities, people feel like, oh, no one cares what I think. No one cares what I'm doing. And, just from the onset when we get in, because I remember a project I did in KZN where they were doing a waste reuse, water reuse plant. And they said, we want to tell the people about this. I said, it's not as simple as it sounds. So we'll start with, how do the people feel about this project? And turns out 90% of the people didn't know what the project meant. So they were like, okay, that's our results then. I'm like, no. Now the onus is on you to go back and educate them so they can make an informed decision. Because if I don't know what it is, how can I tell you whether I want it or not? So, and from an engineering point of view, it's seemed like a waste of time and money and energy. And I said, once you start the process, now you need to complete it. So you've asked them, do they want it? They said they don't know what it is. Now you go back, you tell them what it is, all through research and surveys and questionnaires and workshops. And once the workshop is done, now you can ask them, do they want it? And yes, it's happening in three parts, but at least you'll have a good conscience knowing that these people agreed to this, and it wasn't just sprung on them. So it opens the door for further projects and bigger projects in the community where, firstly, they trust you, but secondly, they understand that you have their best interests at heart, and genuinely so.
And was there eventually buy-in into the KZN project?
So we are now at the second step, which is very exciting. We've done some workshops and very interesting. We even took them to the wastewater treatment plant to show them how it works. So now once this we've done a small group, so we've piloted I think 40 people. We're going back, and then we will, once we get into the answers and communicating, because they've even given us some solutions, then we do the survey again and ask them, so now do you want this?
And it's such a great thing, I think, from a work-wise and university point of view, is that you have this opportunity to work in completely different geographies. Just because you're based in Johannesburg doesn't mean that your work has to just be Joburg-based. And often the learnings, especially from an academic point of view, have this great potential to go across not just your own country, but into different nations around the world. Prof. Modley, we are unfortunately coming to the end of the show, and there are so many more things that I wanted to ask you. But one of the things that you've clearly demonstrated is your commitment to being a professional, your commitment to the community, and also, obviously, your personal life. You juggle multiple roles. How do you approach balancing your career with home and personal life?
So I think I'm really privileged in this regard because I have an incredible support system. So my husband, we've been together almost 20 years, and he started this journey with me in the lab, cutting fish, everything. So from day one, he knew the path that I would be taking, and since then supported me, which of course is not easy. Some days I have to travel out of the country, be gone for a week, sometimes 2 weeks, and he would be with the kids. So between him, his mother, and his sister, they would rotate with the kids. Sometimes they'd sleep at our house, sometimes they cook. And of course, my parents, with the support that they've given me, it's made it so much more easier because it's never a 8-hour day. It's always more than that. And, I play my role. I ensure just to keep the routine, I try and cook, I help with homework, and make sure I put them to bed, which is very important for them. So I think my support system has been incredible. And of course, being with my children and keeping the routine has helped that form of discipline. I try to do strength training when I can, just so that I don't just fixate on work, but also make time to make sure that my health is on top of where it should be. And of course, this whole journey and everything is based on my faith. So I'm a Jesus baby, and I think all the glory should go to him in every way, because everything works out the way he planned for it to work out. You know, when people say to me, "How did you get this right? You've been busy the whole week." And I'm like, "I'm fueled by God's strength. I don't know. I wish I could tell you how, but God has really carried me through this journey, even days when I thought, I mean, I had two babies during my PhD. So things that I think I would have thought is impossible has really been made possible through my faith and God being the center.
You've really demonstrated today that you, as a woman, you don't have to be confined to one avenue in your life, that you can have a full, enriching life of career, of family, of faith, of community engagement, just by feeding it the right types of ingredients and support structures to draw your strength off of. Lastly, as we close out today's show, please share a few words of wisdom or inspiration you'd like to pass on to girls and young women that are listening to us.
Okay, so I think, of course, I have to say that it's important to keep God at the center of everything. For me, that is really important. And just to understand that people would try and put labels on you. People will try and, you know, give you sort of limits that you can't reach. I think what fuels me as well is breaking those glass ceilings. So when someone says to me, "No, but it hasn't been done before. You can't do it. You know, you're just a little colored girl from El Dorado Park," this pushes me to my maximum. I just want to prove to you that it can be done. So I think when someone puts a limit on you, when someone tells you it can't be done, this is actually your opportunity to prove them wrong. So I think throughout my life, I've done that. When someone says to me, "You know, we've never seen your kind doing this," I'm like, "Oh, okay. Let me prove you wrong." So even though people will come with negativity and people will come with trying to undermine you, don't look at it in a negative way. This is your opportunity to prove them wrong. And I think that that's really been something that I've carried throughout my life. If it can't be done, if I'm not doing it, it means it can't be done. So that's really what I just want to share with young girls. Any limit that's being put on you is just an opportunity for you to prove them wrong.
Thank you for that powerful message that everyone listening is limitless. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we've been talking to Associate Professor Leanne Modley from the Department of Geography, Environmental Management and Energy Studies at the University of Johannesburg.